Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Poison Pen this afternoon. We're excited to have two wonderful authors with us. One, you know, over on the left, Liv Constantine. Can you raise your wiggle? Right. Actually, this is Lynn, who is half of Liv Constantine. She writes with her sister, and they are the authors of The Last Mrs. Parrish, The Last Time I Saw You, and their wonderful new book over here called The Wife Stalker. In fact, we did a program with Liv, both sisters, a while back, which you can also watch on Facebook. And today, the book that we've come to talk about is by Julie Clark, and it's called The Last Flight. There's Julie. Can you hold up your book? Excellent. The reason she's holding up her book and we aren't is that the copies she signed for the Poison Pen just shipped yesterday. So it is our July first mystery book of the month, and they should be in at the end of the week. And we certainly encourage you to order a copy because it's a terrific read. And also, it's always good to buy in when an author is beginning because you never know how it will go. Generally up, as opposed to down. So let me read a short quote from the New York Times Book Review just to get going. The Last Flight is thoroughly absorbing, not only because of its tantalizing plot and deft pacing, but also because of its unexpected poignancy and its satisfying, bittersweet resolution. The characters get under your skin. Now, when you read this, you're going to have to decide for yourself how you feel about the resolution. I think it'll be an excellent book club book because there's a lot to talk about. What we have are two women in desperate need of escape. One is a New Yorker called Claire Cook, and the other is Eva James from Berkeley. And by chance, they meet in a bar at JFK, and off we go. So, Lynn, I'm going to ask to turn this over to you, and I know you are brilliantly prepared, and we look forward to your conversation.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, and I would totally agree with the New York Times. I absolutely devoured this book, and I think about 2 days was amazing. So Julie, it's your second book and it got a starred review from Kirkus. It's also Book of the Month Club for July, which is just awesome. So I wanted to start off by talking a little bit about the two protagonists. So as Barb mentioned, this goes back and forth between two women, Eva and Claire. And even though they are very different, there are, you know, similarities in their past, I think, that bind them. So what I'm curious is, when you were writing it, did you start with characters or did you start with the plot?
I started with Claire and her situation, needing to disappear, wanting to disappear, figuring out how she could do that, get a fake ID, get a fake passport, and vanish. And then I realized that I needed her to die in a way that nobody would be able to recover the body, so that there was no doubt that she was truly gone. Her plan to vanish, I should preface this, her plan to vanish falls apart. She has this plan to disappear on a campaign event for her husband, who's horribly abusive, and he discovers or changes her plan at the last minute, and he's moments away from discovering what she was about to do. And so that's where she and Eva trade plane tickets, thinking that it will give them a head start somewhere new where nobody will be looking for her. And when the plane goes down with carrying Eva, Claire realizes it's not just a head start, but a new start. And I originally played around with different ways to get Claire to sort of be able to vanish through some kind of natural disaster. I played around a little bit with using 9/11 as a way for a body to not be recovered. Somebody wrote that book, so I had to change it. And that's really at that point where Eva was born, because I needed somebody to be in cahoots with her about this. And I didn't want that person to necessarily get in the way of Claire's arc.
Interesting. So that's kind of like a necessity being the mother of invention, where, right, yeah, where Eva came out of that circumstance. Mm-hmm. But then Eva, of course, does end up playing a major role in the book, and she's a main character. So, you know, like you, Valerie and I write books usually with two women, two female protagonists. And sometimes it's a little difficult to balance, really. You're trying to get in the head of your character. You have two very different characters that you're doing that with. So what were the challenges with that? You know, if you want to talk a little bit, did you have to do them like one story at a time, or were you able to like go back and forth? How did that work?
I really needed to get the beats of the story down for Claire first. And then I backed up and figured out a story arc for Eva that would work kind of once I put the two together. So I had a very clear vision of what Claire's arc would be. And then I backed up and had a very clear vision of what Eva's arc would be. And there were plenty of times where I was just revising one character or the other, printing out all of Claire's chapters and revising just Claire, reading through just Claire, and then printing out all of Eva's chapters and reading through just Eva, making sure they each had a full arc, a beginning, a middle, and an end that felt real, and made sure that each character was fleshed out and felt like their backstory had enough weight to it to kind of carry them forward. And then I had to put it together, which was a challenge to make sure that the pacing for each arc matched. So I didn't want any one character to be lagging while the other character's pacing was picking up. I really wanted that pacing to be kind of matched between the two characters. So getting their stories to sort of climax at the same time was a challenge. Took a lot of note cards and a lot of rearranging and a lot of moving things around and changing chapters, combining chapters. It was complicated at that point.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense though about doing it that way. I can see. Then, well, that leads me to my next question in terms of how you write. I mean, do you write organically or did you plot everything out? I mean, I know you talk about the note cards. So do you do a few chapters at a time or did you know the whole story before you really sat down to write it?
I know just the main beats of the story. So I kind of know the what if scenario and I know sort of the launching off point that sort of propels the character into their new journey. I generally know what will happen at the midpoint and I always know how the book will end. So what happens in between there is sort of the more day-to-day drafting.
Gotcha. And I'm just wondering also, did you find yourself relating more or closer to either Eva or Claire? You know, did you end up sort of being more invested in one or the other personally or?
Probably Eva, only because she was harder to write for me. I really had to, there were many months where in the draft, readers were feeling much more connected to Claire. And so I really had to sit with Eva and make the time to sort of know her inside and out. And I think because I did that, I feel pretty emotionally connected to her. And probably also because she's so flawed and yet still so likable, you know?
I liked her a lot. I mean, and it's interesting. I feel like both women were victimized by men in their lives and, you know, and just circumstantially ended up in very different places. But, you know, in reality and physically, but not really emotionally. I mean, really both emotionally ended up in this sort of in the same place, even though Claire had the money and all of that kind of thing. So, I mean, I wonder had they had the opportunity later to connect or, you know, and be in the same path, do you think they would have been friends?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I just do. And I think that when you experience something with someone like Claire and Eva did together, I mean, they're only in one chapter together at the very beginning. And then after that, they're never together again. So I do feel like they would be. I do feel like they are connected and will always be connected to each other. I know that's in my mind how they would feel.
Yeah, I see that too. And I loved the way you know that you brought also in that friendship with Eva, you know, with the professor, and how that, you know, and I won't get into any spoilers. I mean, all of that was fascinating, and how that all interconnected. And again, just I think you deal with a lot of themes of family and loss, mother-daughter relationships, you know, and you wonder as well, you know, had Eva had someone like that early in her life, how would she have turned out? And same thing with Claire, if she hadn't lost her mother and her sister. So how, I mean, do you intentionally bring in these sort of themes of loss and family? Does it just a byproduct of the story, or, you know, how does that work with you, with your writing?
I generally start with the plot first and then try to think about, you know, well, what is this story really about? What is it that I want readers to be feeling on a deeper level? Not just, woo, that was a great story, but really an emotional level to it, sort of like a third rail that sort of lights people up from inside. That's really important to me. My first book was Upmarket Fiction, and so it's very much an emotional journey of the character and, you know, relationships and feelings. And it's not always found in thrillers. It is definitely, I know writers that do it very well, but, you know, it always takes a second place to plot. And so for me, I kind of wanted them to be co-equal parts of the book. So the emotional part was really important to me, and making sure that both of those characters, and the best way I felt to make Eva likable because of what she does and how she's grown up, was to make sure we understood that we, how she got there, to make sure we understood what obstacles she had already overcome. And then to put her in a situation with a character like Liz, the professor, where we can really see her being a version of her best self. All right. of these things are sort of, I think, tools that authors use to make sure that you can take an unlikable character who should be unlikable and make sure that we have a lot of empathy for them, no matter what the choices are that they make.
Yeah, I think you did a great job with that, because I definitely felt that way. In the beginning, I wasn't so sure about Eva, but of course, as I got to know her, you know, it did change my mind. I mean, and even some, even with the minor characters, you had that surprise with Claire and this woman who she thought was just being this, you know, officious spy who's really trying to look out for her and kind of take care of her. You know, and I think it's good. I mean, it's sort of this women, you know, we're in a time where hopefully we're being more supportive and trying to help each other as opposed to being competitive. So without giving any spoilers, of course, the ending is quite a shock. Now, you said you knew from the beginning how the book was going to end. So were there any surprises at all, or did you struggle with that, or did you want to change anything with that ending, or did you just know?
I struggled with it. I struggled with it for sure. You know, my editor and I went back and forth a lot on it and how and what would be best. And it just felt the ending that I chose really felt true to the story and true to the characters and true to life, which is really all I'm going to say about it. If we do a book club discussion later with readers who've already read it, I'm happy to really dive deep into my reasoning and whatnot. But yeah, I get messages from readers all the time, just saying, you know, the ending, can we talk about the ending? And, you know, I'm always happy to do that because, you know, I'm not allowed to talk about it here. And so it's hard.
No.
No, it's interesting. I mean, I think we've moved away from that. You know, endings can be very different now than they were, say, 10 or 15 years ago. And I never forget when Gillian Flynn was at Thriller Fest and she was talking about Gone Girl. And of course, everybody, and not that I'm comparing your ending to Gone Girl at all, I'm not saying that, but I'm just talking about an ending that maybe isn't expected by readers. You know, and even myself at the time, I kept thinking, I loved this book, but I'm not sure about the ending. And she said, you know, readers would come up to her and say that, and she would look at them and say, but how else did you really think things could turn out for these characters? You know what I mean? It stuck with me. And it's true that, you know, we do as writers, hopefully a really good job of making the story authentic to the characters. At least that's what we try to. So you have to do the same with the ending. And it's sometimes it's great and popular. Some people love that and other people want them more predictable. But I think, yeah, I mean, I felt very shocked by the ending, but then sort of it is kind of that surprise, but inevitable, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Kind of an ending. So
that was.
Right. So I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about your writing journey, how, you know, what you, again, this is your second book, like, you know, how you got where you are, how just talk to readers and tell us how you ended up with this great book. You know, this, you're like on your way to a wonderful writing career, and I'm sure people would like to know how that happened.
I always wanted to write, but never could pull it off with either paid work or just, you know, when I was younger, I would throw my hat in the ring with, you know, short pieces to Cosmo or whatever, and nothing ever happens. And it wasn't really something that I was ready to pursue. I took a lot of writing courses. I worked at UC Berkeley for a while and was able to take a lot of classes for free there because I was an employee. And so I took some wonderful writing classes, creative writing classes with some great professors, and they were all very encouraging and said, you know, you really need to do this. You really need to do this. And I just kind of thought, oh, you know, I mean, I was 25 at the time, you know, I was like, sure, you know, I'll do it. And then you grow up, you get a job and you have kids and, you know, I'm a single mom now. I have a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old. And so I really couldn't sit down and write a book until my youngest was sleeping through the night, basically. I mean, I was doing all of it by myself. I had my kids full time. You know, I was up with the kids. I was, you know, teaching full time, and it was just not something that I could tackle. So I didn't even sit down and try to write until I was maybe 42 or 43. And I wrote a book and it went nowhere. I queried it because I thought it was fabulous. And of course, nobody else thought it was fabulous. And so I thought, okay, well, I will write another book. I mean, I think writing a book and knowing that you can do it, that you can actually complete it, whether it's good or not, is a huge, huge accomplishment. And so I knew that I could do it. I knew that I could take a story and develop it. And my friends liked it. My critique partners liked it. So I knew that it wasn't horrible. And so I did it again. And I wrote what turned out to be my debut, The Ones We Choose. And that did end up getting me an agent. And it did end up getting me a publishing contract. And it was just from there, I just kept writing. Because once you start, you invest a lot of time into the process of it, your characters. And, you know, I get up every morning at 3:45 to write until 6 o'clock. That's my writing time because no kid is up at that hour. So I write from about 4 in the morning to 6 in the morning. And now that we're kind of shut in our houses, I'll write till 7. And then I'm done for the day. It's like working out. You know, if you get it done first, then it's not hanging over your head all day and you're not kind of bitter about it and you don't feel like, oh God, I gotta do this. So, you know, and you can write entire books in just 2 or 3 hours a day. It's definitely possible, but you have to do it every day and you have to just keep pushing forward. You know, when you have an idea, I'm struggling with my third book right now. I have a half a draft. I have no idea where it's going. I'm at that stage now where I really do need to sit back and think, what is this book about? Like, I know what the plot is, but like, what is this book really about? What am I trying to say? And right now the question is, I don't know. And so, you know, this is sort of the part, this is the place where a lot of people sort of say, oh, I'm going to do a different idea. And I'm tempted, believe me, I'm tempted to say, I'm going to set this aside and try something else. But this is really where the rubber meets the road, you know, and as a writer, it's, you know, 10% drafting and 90% revision and rewriting. And you just got to stick with it and keep massaging it and keep reworking it and working it and working it until it ends up something that is actually good enough to publish. It takes a long time.
I agree. Well, I think what you said is very important in the sense that you wrote that first book and instead of kind of exhausting all your querying for years and years and years and pushing, you put it down and you wrote your next book. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the best pieces of advice I ever got, was just write the next book. And, you know, and I think too, what you're saying is true in terms of struggling with the book, but I will say there are times, you know, that if a book, you can put a book aside, start a new one, and always go back to that too. So, I mean, but I think, you know, whether or not it's just that it's tough and you're like, you know, you don't want to push through, right? Or whether it really is just not necessarily, you know, the right direction. And I do think, I'm hearing from a lot of writers right now that it's tough, obviously, with everything that's going on. I mean, we're all under a tremendous amount of stress. Even if you try to kind of have tunnel vision and focus on what you're doing, there's no way to avoid the anxiety and in so many areas, right? And a lot of people are having a hard time writing. So it's great that despite that, you're able to have the discipline to sit down and say, it doesn't matter, I'm going to sit down and write it. And, you know, whether or not You're right. That's exactly how it gets done, is you got to sit in the chair and you just have to do it.
Yeah.
So I was wondering too, for your writing for this one, especially, well, all of it, like, can you talk a bit about research? How do you do your research, and, you know, how important, like, is it mostly online, or do you get into experts? How does that go for you?
With this particular book, I didn't have as much research as I did with my first one, where I had to basically write a geneticist and do a tons of genetic research, which turned out to be much more fun than I thought it would be. With this one, happily, I didn't have to do a lot of research. So I used the experts in my life. I have a friend who used to be an FBI agent and kind of used to do a lot of undercover work. And so he's sort of my law enforcement contact, and I talked to him and asked him questions, and I interviewed him extensively about many things, how to get a fake ID, how would one go about doing it, if I wanted to do that, where would I go, who would I talk to, and he had, you know, I mean, his answer was the Russian mafia is literally the only game in town. They are very, very good at what they do. So if you can get your character in a room with someone like that, and with enough money, it'd be about $10,000, he estimated, maybe a little bit more now. That's definitely the way to go. I did not reach out to any Russian mafia people to ask them. because I personally am a very fearful and cautious person. People always ask me, well, would you trade plane tickets in an airport with a stranger? And I absolutely not. You know, I might not even talk to the stranger at the airport. I have a friend who's a flight attendant and ran a lot of stuff by him. Could you trade tickets at an airport if you were already through security? And he said, absolutely, yes, you can. They really don't check. And it was surprising to me. I mean, the whole book really hinges on this idea that these two women can change tickets, kind of swap out their outer clothing, change bags, hand everything off, and literally board a flight that they are not supposed to be on. And you absolutely can do that right now. I don't know why anybody would want to, but he said at this point, at this time, there's really no way for them to know. And I have Claire or Eva using Claire's phone to, you know, the boarding pass that's texted to you. I mean, if you're willing to give up your wallet and your ID and your phone and everything else, then, you know, they're really, they can't stop you.
No, but I like that too, that, you know, the depth of research, because it's I find it frustrating when there's a premise that is really shaky, and, you know, especially as you said, when the whole book hinges on it, it has to be realistic and it has to be something that can be done. So I think, you know, and it made sense. Like, okay, yeah, I mean, then it makes a lot of sense that you could do that. Scary. So I don't know, you may be hearing from TSA.
Yeah, so I mean, I just hope
for your book, right? You maybe get it.
I hope we can sell enough copies before they change the rules.
Right. Yeah, well, that's true. If you change food, yeah, you won't be able to put like restaurant scenes or trying clothes on in stores or anything, right? The world is changing so fast. So yeah. Hopefully that will go back. I know you're working on your third. I want to ask you what. Will you stay? Because you said your first book was not a psychological thriller. This is more in that genre. Do you think you'll continue to write in that genre, or will you just move around? And
I do. I mean, I like to write emotional page turners, and you know, my next book is definitely it might not be like a heart pounding thriller, but it's definitely like suspense, domestic suspense, dark secrets, possibly a murder. You know, so yeah.
You're progressing to murder. That's what happens. Like, we started with our book.
Slowly, yeah.
And then a second book is more, yeah, it gets, it's like, you know, it's not a disease, but something progressive. But no, it's fun. I mean, I think what's not to in this genre, there's so much that you can write about. And it's certainly much better to write about the domestic drama than live it, I would say.
I would say so.
So what is something readers, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I do think that it's a lot easier when you're writing thrillers and suspense to really put your characters in situations, number one, that you wouldn't be in yourself, but to really put them in peril in a way that wouldn't work in any kind of general fiction book. So, you know, my goal right now is like, how can I make things worse? How can I make things more dangerous for her? How can I make things fall apart even more. Like, what else could she possibly lose? Her husband, her finances, her home, her child. Like, how else can I, what else can I take away from her? You know, so that in a thriller is a lot, it's a lot more fun. You have a lot more options.
Sounds horrible. It is. Did you ever see the movie with Will Ferrell, Stranger Than Fiction, where he's a character and the narrator is talking about his life and he's like horrified and they're talking about what's going to happen? So my sister and I, when we're doing that and we're doing the same thing, we're saying, all right, well, maybe we could do that to the person. And we imagine our character, like, don't do that. Don't kill me off. Because you definitely are having this role where you're putting them through their paces. Mm-hmm. So what is something your readers might be surprised to learn about you, other than the fact that you're a chicken, a scaredy cat about stuff? Is there something, a hobby or a quirk or something that you want to share?
No, I am, every time somebody asks me this question, I just think I am the most boring person in the world. I get up every day, I do my job, I teach, I parent, I wash a lot of dishes, I cook a lot of, batches of macaroni and cheese, I take the dog to the groomer. It's just, but I like a boring life. I mean, I had breast cancer in 2015, so maybe people don't know that, and recovered from that and wrote all throughout my treatment and all throughout that period of my life. And I think people are always really surprised when I talk about how that was a really positive experience for me. It was transformative in a way that I don't think a lot of people have the privilege to have. But again, I have really great health insurance. I have a very supportive family. I had a job that allowed me to take time off. So, I mean, I hate that that's the most interesting thing that's happened to me in the last 10 years or so, but I also feel like it really impacted the choices that I make and the person that I am and how I choose to live my life and look at things. But it's also why I love the fact that there's absolutely nothing interesting about me. It's sort of happily, I am a boring person who goes through her days. And like the most exciting thing that I do right now is work on my puzzle every night before bedtime.
And well, I think it's extraordinary that you have that you're the type of person that will take an experience like that and turn it into something, and to be able to say, you're just happy to get up and be healthy and have your family, right? And I would guess the little things, you don't sweat, probably the small stuff, and right? I think, and to say that it's a gift, I think that's quite remarkable, actually. Don't call yourself boring. I think that's great. Yes. So you're working on book three. So I didn't ask you, what do you teach?
I teach fifth grade.
Oh, wow. Okay. So were you having to do like the Zoom with your online teaching and all of that?
Yeah. It was not great.
How was that?
We're probably going to continue that in the fall. I have to for my health reasons. But I know it was horrible in the spring. I know for a fact it will be so much better. We had no planning. We had no prep. We had no training. We knew nothing. I had never done a Zoom in my life. It's a process. So I know that online learning will be better in the fall than it was in the spring for all those panicked parents out there. But I'm in Los Angeles right now and we are just out of control with our coronavirus cases here. I mean, it's just exponentially getting worse and worse and worse every day. We've closed the beaches this weekend. I don't know when they'll open up again. It's just, it's the reality. So that was really hard. I miss my students. I miss that face-to-face contact with them. I love my job. Everybody keeps asking, when are you going to quit and write full time? And I'm thinking, why would I do that? Why would I quit? I like my job. I love a steady paycheck. Book advances are wonderful, but at the same time, they're spread out across a really long period of time. That's not, you look at the total number, it's great. But then when you piece it out across the course of 2 or 3 years, it's really not that great. So, I love having healthcare. So there are all kinds of reasons that, you know, I really don't want to quit my job. I love teaching. I love talking to the kids. It gets me out of my head and out of whatever book problems I'm having. It's a great complement to writing because it gets me out of the house and engaging with people. And then when the students at school are starting to frustrate me or act out or not do what I want them to do, I get to come home and my characters always do exactly what I want them to do. So it balances very nicely.
That does sound, that sounds like the perfect thing. Well, I think it's great. I mean, you love what you, that's the whole point, isn't it? Yeah. To love what we do and look forward to what we're doing, getting up every day. And you know, do you have boys? Are you, you? I know you said you had two kids. Are they boy, girl, or what is the? Do you have a daughter and a son? Is that
two boys?
Okay. Have you? Did your older one read your books? I'm always curious. I have twins, boy, girl, 19. So yeah, you know, they read some of my stuff, not all my stuff. But I'm sorry.
Yeah, my oldest read the book and he loved it. Thought it was great. My 14-year-old loved it. And he didn't have any issue with any of the language. He said, "Oh my God, I hear worse at school every day. Are you kidding me?" I try not to put too much bad language in my books, but I also feel like to be true to the character, especially when I'm talking about like the drug underworld of Berkeley, they're not gonna, you know, say shoot and darn it. They're just not.
Yeah, exactly. So, I know it's a tough. Yeah, I get you. I hear you on that.
Yeah,
oh, that's really cool. All right, well, do we have any questions that we have, Barbara, from the audience?
Hang on, we'll find out. Patrick is going to wander over here and read a couple to you.
Yeah, there are a few. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. Actually, we have an author that you may know that's watching, Heather Gudenkauf.
Oh, yeah.
And she asks, what research did you do as you wrote the novel? This is for Julie.
I
know you touched on that a little bit, but.
I did. I also, you know, spent, since I used to work at Berkeley, I worked at the university in the athletic department there. So I liked to weave a lot of that into the book. I have Eva and her sort of partner Dex spending a lot of time in the athletic facilities, because one of the things that is, I found it to be such a great tie-in to places that I love. Berkeley, first of all, is a town that I love. It was a university that I loved working at, and I loved the people that I worked with while I was there. So going back and writing those venues again, Memorial Stadium, Haas Pavilion, walking across campus, I was able to visit Berkeley again in 2018. I took my kids there, my parents went along, and I did a lot of walking the trails that Eva and Claire would walk. I found the coffee shop where I felt like this could be the coffee shop where Kelly works. I know exactly where the house is in the Strawberry Canyon that I wanted, you know, that I wanted the book to take place in, and in another part of the book. And so using the athletic facilities was actually sort of one of those moments where my own personal life dovetailed with what I needed to happen in the story. And so Dex and Eva are sort of having to be very careful. They've got a DEA agent that seems to be sniffing around and asking a lot of questions. And so they use the athletic facilities as a way to keep sort of what they're doing, which is making drugs and selling drugs. They use the athletic facilities as a way to sort of put another layer of security. So Eva is a season ticket holder for football and basketball, which gives her all kinds of access to club level venues that are very exclusive and you can't get in without, you know, without an ID. Now, of course, like a police officer could get in with just showing their badge, but it would be a big deal. It would definitely tip them off. It would allow them time to escape. And so using the facilities in that way, I apologize to all my colleagues at Berkeley for using our beloved Memorial Stadium and Haas Pavilion as sort of places where drug dealers exchange drugs. But, you know, it certainly worked well. So it's doing a lot of research at Berkeley was an added bonus for me because it allowed me to go back and see places that I loved and worked at 20 plus years ago, probably, I want to say now, 25 years ago. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Okay, another question about, this is actually my own question. I'm interested in, you know, people disappearing. I think that speaks to something we've all thought about at one time or another. You know, just curious how that would work. Is it possible? You know, these days with technology being so sophisticated, it's harder and harder to do that. Did you find yourself kind of going down the rabbit hole of that kind of research? You know, just what would it take to pull this off successfully? And as a corollary to that, did you study WITSEC at all, the WITSEC program? Or
no. Oh, you mean the Witness Protection Program?
Yes.
Yeah. I knew I didn't want her to do that because that would bring in a lot of law enforcement that she really was not interested in getting involved in. Claire wants to just disappear. She doesn't want to call her abusive, powerful husband out. She knows what happens to women when they do that. Her husband is a very powerful and influential politician from a very powerful political dynasty family. And she knew that that wouldn't go well for her. So going to the police was not an option. She just didn't want money. She didn't want a divorce. She literally wanted to vanish and let him look for her for the rest of his life. So be it, you know? And she knew that she needed the right tools to do that. I felt like the Witness Protection Program would bring a level of law enforcement in. And really, you have to... you have to give them something. And so I do have a DEA agent and I do have Eva actually asking to be put in the Witness Protection Program, but she has something to offer, whereas Claire did not. So, you know, they're not, it's very, and I did talk to my friend about that, about the Witness Protection Program and like how often do they offer it? And he says, you know, it's very, very hard to get put into that Witness Protection Program. You really, really have to give them something of high, high value because it's very expensive to do. It's very expensive to maintain. It takes a lot of manpower to do that well. You don't just give someone a new ID and like say, see you later and good luck to you. And by the way, your name's Joe now. You really have to, I mean, they really do a lot of work to cultivate a backstory and an identity and, you know, family and all of these things so that when they put you in the protection program, no matter who you encounter, won't have any questions about where did you come from and you know, who are you? And it's just very, very expensive. So it was not an option for Claire, for sure. It is an option for Eva, but you'll have to read the book and find out how that goes.
Were there any kind of true cases, true narratives that you kind of read about where people who did successfully disappear?
No. I mean, I didn't do a lot of research on who did it successfully because if there's research on it, they didn't. So if we know about it, then it's not successful.
That's a really excellent point. Right.
That is an excellent point.
Yeah. A very excellent point. I'm going to interject something here, too, because I had an experience in December which would actually completely foil your plot, which is that another author and I flew to Egypt on a research trip. I'm her editor for her British publisher, strangely enough. But anyway, when we got to Tom Bradley International Airport, we had all our documents, our passports, and you know our tickets and the whole bit. And when we arrived at the Lufthansa gate, they said, just put it all away. And you went through a facial recognition program. No passport, no ticket, nothing. You were, in fact, your recognition. And I reckon if they install that, which is usually expensive, but it's probably coming, documents and successfully board a flight, especially an international flight, or even Puerto Rico, as it happens in this book, go away. So, you know, it's wonderful to write a book in which the technology works for you and not worry about whether it's going to be superseded. You can only write about what's possible when you write the book. You can't look ahead. But I do think that the way we travel is going to change increasingly, and you will really become your own document, and that will make it much more difficult.
That's one of the reasons why I had them going to that, why I had Claire going to Puerto Rico, is that I knew that if I had her going somewhere international, she would need a passport on the other end. You have to get through customs and somehow, and I didn't want to be fiddling around with passports and customs, and there needed to be, I mean, even though Eva never gets that far, I needed it to be something that the characters themselves weren't worrying about. So that's why I chose Puerto Rico. I needed the plane to crash over the water. I needed it to be far enough away so that Claire could get to California and the crash could have already happened and been reported. So there was a lot of like moving puzzle pieces around to figure out where she could go that would be close enough, but far enough that would that is still considered a domestic flight, but would take us over water. You know, that ruled Hawaii out because timing wise, that just wouldn't work. But I did need the plane crash to happen over water, mostly because I'm a scaredy cat and I didn't want to have it crash over land. I didn't want to deal with that. I didn't want to deal with that kind of recovery. I think an ocean recovery is a little bit more challenging and it opens up a lot of opportunities for uncertainty in a way that a land crash wouldn't. And for people who are worried about reading about plane crashes because they're scary, I hear you and I feel you, and I don't like to read them either. So all of that happens off the page. So you don't need to worry about that. You're not living through a plane crash in reading this book. So have no fear.